You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, David Ewing. How are you doing today, David?
Doing great, Sam. Can't complain.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And so you own a couple businesses. You own Motive and Content Line, correct?
That's the rumor. Yes, I've got both those companies, and I'm trying to do the dual CEO thing. And it's given me a new appreciation for a controversial, polarizing figure like Elon Musk, because I don't know how he does it, but I'm doing the best I can. So kind of a wannabe tech bro.
Yes. Well, it's got to be difficult at the two number for sure, right? Because you're probably still to some end, I mean, definitely heavily involved in both. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, fortunately, I've got a lot of synergy between the two businesses. So I'm sure we'll get into like how I got to where I got. But the synergy is what allows me to do them. It's not like one is having to do with cars and the other has to do with printing or something. They're two related businesses, and that helps quite a bit.
Yeah, and you and I. So you live down in Texas in Dallas, if I recall correct. Did I get that right? I want to make sure I'm wrong.
Bite your tongue, good sir.
Oh,
no, I am not from
so
Dallas.
Sorry.
Although I'm a Rangers fan, but no,
okay,
I'm from Austin.
Okay, okay.
So I'm from
Austin.
That weird city
so
in the middle. So that's okay.
Very, very different cities. I've had family to and from lately. That's where my brother's at. So that's where my mental, you'll forgive me. That's the first one I throw at the board.
I'm going to give you a bone on this one because my last name is Ewing, right? And for people who are Generation X or above, they remember that the TV show Dallas, which was all about the Dallas Ewings. And it was the number one TV show back in the 80s when I was a small child. The Dallas Ewings is a common mistake, but I'm the Austin Ewings. Different show.
Different show. Fantastic. One that you were writing in tandem. So, okay.
Right.
That's exciting. Cool. And you and I, we met over, quick momentary shout out to Entrepreneurs Organization. We met at the Eccentric conference. Yeah?
You know,
if I recall.
Entrepreneurs Organization is such a wild card of success that yes, it does deserve a shout out, because anyone listening to your podcast who's not a member of EO should be trying to as best they can to qualify and get in as soon as they can. The amount of people that I have met that have become business partners, investors, customers, even though there's a non-solicitation clause, like, it's been extraordinary. And yeah, I think you and I bumped into each other sitting next to each other at breakfast and struck up a conversation on day two. And here we are. So
it was a fun and fast conversation, too. I specifically remember I was like, man, this guy's fun to talk to. Not that. And that's the cool thing about EO. I'd say for the most part, a lot of the folks are fun to talk to. But, you know, as well as I do, sometimes the conversation is not quite as easy and as fast going.
Well, there's just so much. If you're an entrepreneur, there's so much that you can relate to with other entrepreneurs, because we've all been embezzled from. We've all had, been mercifully flogged on Glassdoor. We've all had, all kinds of crazy last minute heroics. We've all, so it's like when you meet somebody who's been in those shoes, how hard is it to really become friends,
Careful not to hit it too accurately. Did we hit off a conversation with my partner? Because when you went straight to embezzlement, I was like, oh, shoot, I wish that wasn't as accurate as it was.
Well, like, I remember being at an EO conference maybe 10 years ago, and they were like, hey, raise your hands if you've been embezzled from by one of your employees. And like half the hands went up, and they're like, all right, half of you just are being embezzled from and don't know it yet. Yeah, it's tough.
I bet I've got a friend, Krista. I bet she would love that. So she used to be like a special agent for the IRS, and now she does fraud investigation. And, firms like this will bring her in when it's like, hey, we're worried there might be embezzlement happening. Can you, track it down? And we need you to be a professional witness if it goes to trial. And she does this thing called the fraud triangle. And it's basically, she just locks in how literally anybody is capable of this. It just requires these three ingredients, which are basically, I mean, it's means, motive, and opportunity is the three ingredients. They reworded a little bit for fraud, but that, you know, as long as you have all three, then yeah, you're going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, every business requires some amount of trust, no matter how many checks and balances you have. And, you know, you have to just decide, like, is it a cost of doing business? And, you know, there's always the sense of betrayal if and when it happens. And it hurts so bad. I think the loss of money is bad, but the pain of the betrayal is so much worse that I think that, yeah, it's great to be able to commiserate with people who've had something like that happen. But yeah, you know, there's also the good stuff too, right? The deal that you close, the big opportunity that you get, you know, the wonderful employees who build lives and careers with you. And, you know, I think to be more positive about it, it's a wonder it doesn't happen more often than it does, you know? And so the fact is, it doesn't happen that often. To me, it's only happened once, but it was horrible. And so, yes, it's you go to EO and you just have so many shared experiences with other entrepreneurs and you get a toolkit of how to deal with that. And and I think that, you know, that it can be a lonely feeling to be an entrepreneur. And so, yeah, when you are with the with your tribe, they come from all stripes, but they're still your tribe, you know, and that's really cool.
Well, to add to the positivity, It's only been once for me too, and I don't even know if it would technically qualify. And I don't know how you'd qualify it. Just backstabbing partner. But it adds to the sniffer, in my opinion. Like you get a pretty good nose after that, so to speak, for kind of the next sort of, at least in my opinion. Yeah. I don't know if you found to be similar or not. I mean, what they say, failure or whatever you want to call it, is the best lesson, right?
Yeah.
Making that mistake, learning the hard way.
The thing I always say to my kids is, you know, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
Yeah. There's some truth to that. So let's dive into, so what is Motive? What is Content Line? What are these businesses that you're running?
Yeah. So Motive is a company that is focused on increasing customer lifetime value. So we go in and we're hired by large high growth companies who say my average customer lifetime value is, you know, $3,000 over a, you know, 2-year period, or it's, you know, $50,000 over a 5-year period, whatever it is. And we start looking at the mechanics of, like, well, can you get that customer to buy more often? Can you get them to buy a higher ticket price, you know, or upgrade? And can you get more customers, right? And so how do you do that systematically? Well, a lot of it involves systems and a lot of it involves technology. And so we bring to bear the technology that integrates and orchestrates all of the different systems to help a company achieve higher lifetime value from their customers. And so the result is that, you know, pretty much for every dollar they invest in us or our technology partners, you know, they typically can get $2 back in about 24 months. So those projects are exciting. They're challenging. They're in a wide variety of industries, but they tend to gravitate in engineered services, in financial services, and in manufacturing. And so those are some of the places that we do the best in. And so Motive is a technology company that really is about solutions using off-the-shelf technology to make that happen for customers. And typically it's from Oracle because it scales so unbelievably well. It's really cheap. And the innovation pace at Oracle is unbelievable because they drop like $4.5 billion a year on research and development, which compared with other technology companies, it's not close either as a percentage of their revenue or as just in gross dollars. So, you know, the pace of innovation from Oracle is awesome and the cost is low. So it's pretty great. So that's what Motive does. And then Content Line is the second company. And Content Line grew out of Motive because what happened was we implement a lot of technology from Oracle, and Oracle had this wonderful product called Oracle Content Management. And it was really just what it sounds like. It was a place for you to centralize your content, publish it to all sorts of places like mobile apps, websites, email marketing tools, whatever you needed it. You had your content in one place and published it wherever you needed. Super handy tool. And one day Oracle decided, hey, we're done. We want out of this. We're going to keep all the rest of our products. They have like 150 products or whatever, but we're dropping this one. And so that created a gap. And when I looked at the market for what else was out there, nothing really fit the bill. It was too expensive, too old. or you had to buy multiple pieces and kludge them together. So we partnered with Oracle and we built Content Lion on their cloud infrastructure platform. And so Oracle's replacement for that product is our product, Content Lion. So I run two companies. I run Content Lion, which is a content management system that is the born in the age of AI and is really a digital experience platform. And I run Motive, which is a software services company that uses now Oracle and Content Lion to implement for different customers. So that's the synergy that really keeps those things together.
So can you dive in just a little bit further on what exactly Content Lion is, just so I can make sure, because I'm almost visualizing an app that you can store your videos on, and then they publish out to different websites, almost like Postly or something that'll publish out to Facebook. But I think I'm getting it probably slightly wrong, if not majorly wrong.
No, you're not getting it wrong, but that's a sliver of what it does. So imagine this. You're a company and you've got content, right? So what is that content? It's videos, it's images, it's time cards, it's Excel files, it's PDFs, it's HR forms, it's receipts, it's, you know, you name it. Like, just the amount of digital stuff we have in a company is insane. And that's for a small business, but a large business too. And the thing is that not all that content is simply just a digital file, right? If that was the case, you could just use G Drive and just dump all your stuff in a G Drive, right? But
fair.
But, you know, a lot of times you have things like a blog article. Like, what is a blog article? Well, typically it's like the meat of the article, right? But it's also the picture that goes with it that's on the back of the webpage. It's a call to action. It's an author. It's a publishing date. It's a topic. And all of that stuff, if you want to build that and define that structure and say, I have a structure called blog article, I want all my blog articles to follow the same structure. So that way, when I publish it to my mobile app, I might take the thumbnail image, I might take the headline, and I might take the first 100 words of the copy and put that on the mobile app. Or on my website, I'm going to have a list of blog articles that are searchable, but then I also need to have those blog articles on their own pages, right? I need SEO for all of that. So Content Lion is first the big bucket called a digital asset manager, where you just dump all this stuff and AI catalogs and searches it. You define your own structures and then you publish it. And you publish it, what's the industry term, which I don't like because it doesn't make any sense to me, is called headless, which is the idea that I can publish the content without having it in a form, and I can let the application that consumes the content define the form. So how I want it to show up in a mobile app can be decided by the mobile app, but the content comes from my backbone. How I want it to show up on my portal behind a secure firewall, that's going to be different, or my website or a marketing email or wherever the content goes. But the key is I have that content in one place, and then I publish it wherever. And so Content Lion lets you handle highly secure data, like all of your product documents and details, so that you can build a secure portal with Content Lion and let just your secret vendors, you know, see the kernel secret recipe. It lets you publish things to social media. It lets you keep your HR documents where they belong. I mean, any kind of documentation that you need to protect and share in some unusual combination is perfect for Content Lion. It is the place where you centralize all of your data. And then, of course, you can find it if you have access to it, because we have AI search built into it so that you can search and find things based on syntactical meaning and not on just like some lame keywords or things like that. We also can hook it up and hook that into an AI engine. So if you're doing things on ChatGPT and you want to connect and search your information from a particular repository that you have access to on Content Lion, you can do that. So it doesn't matter if you're in product, engineering, marketing, HR, finance, all of them have need for highly secure content that is partially shared with certain people. And so therefore, Content Lion is the solution.
That's exciting. That's exciting. Very cool. I think that's a great space right now, too, for AI. I've started to see, even just on like cell phones and your picture repository and whatever, right, where it's tagging faces, and now you could just click a little button and you have all the pictures of your daughter in Christmas of 20, right? And just how convenient that is. When in the same sort of vein, I mean, I was literally just doing a search earlier for an SOP from an old staff member, and it's kind of like, what was it called? And I think I put it here, but I'm not sure. And actually, I think it might be strewn across three different documents. It's like, now I got to put all the documents together.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that I want to emphasize is, you know, AI is an important part of enabling some of the use cases that we do with ContentLine, but I don't really consider us an AI company. I mean, so many people are claiming they're an AI company, but what they're really doing is they're round tripping information to one of the real AI companies, like a Grok or a ChatGPT or something else. That's what we're doing. Like, only we're doing it in a way that is compliant with the new standard ISO 42, which says, you know, hey, your content needs to be controlled in your enterprise, and it can't be floating around and, you know, getting mixed with some random ChatGPT or other LLM, and then potentially, you know, letting that learn from your content. We don't do any of that. So our content and our GPTs are behind closed doors. They're contained and they're secure, so that, you know, you can't have that risk. And we lock that down for our enterprise customers. But we're not an AI company. We're using AI to make our technology better. And we're the backbone of your content. We're an enabler so that you can do so much more with AI than you could before. But you're doing it in a highly secure way that is making sure that your enterprise information is not leaking out to, you know, the LLM du jour.
So I don't know why, but I feel like this is a perfect transition period. I think why is because there's a clear layer of beautiful depth and complexity in the best sort of way. So you own these two companies that clearly have their own niche, their own vehicle, their own, and you understand them, right? And so now that's where we kind of grab the proverbial time machine dial, right? And let's twist it, let's turn it back, and let's drop David into, I like to do kind of like the high school period, you think 16, 17, 18, 19. And the reason being is because I feel like that's where we've kind of come out of this notion that we're going to be a cowboy astronaut superstar on the moon. We can't quite do that, you know. What's David planning on doing with his life? What is the what are you going to college for? What's the world telling David? Oh, you can't do that. You got to do this.
Yeah. Well, if we want to go back in time to the roaring 90s when I was in high school and was 17, 18 years old, I remember this essay that I wrote. I had this really fascinating English teacher. McDunn, may he rest in peace. He passed away a little while ago. And McDunn asked us to write an essay about what we were going to look like when we were about 40, you know? I remember writing that essay. And in the essay, I was the CEO of a biotech company. And I also remember that my executive assistant was the girl that I crushed on that turned me down. So I had a little personal revenge. Unfortunately, that girl still turned me down. I don't know where she went, but I never got that part right. But I did manage to become the CEO, not in biotech, but of my own company in tech. And so kind of interestingly, yeah, I think when I looked into my crystal ball at 17, I did that. Now, what's really interesting is my dad read the essay, and his reaction to me was, I never knew that you wanted to be an entrepreneur. I never saw you that way. Like, I figured you'd be an engineer or something. And I do love engineering, and I majored in engineering in college, but I always saw engineering as a way to get a technical toolkit and a series of, you know, foundational problem solving skills, and not as my end career. And so, I did that. But that was where I always saw myself. I saw myself as a kind of an entrepreneur, and, didn't describe in that essay the trials and tribulations of an entrepreneur per our earlier conversation, but I managed to describe the highlights of it. And so, that actually turned out to be pretty prescient.
Okay. So, and this is, I can't remember fully if we've talked about this or not, because this feels, some of this definitely resonates with me in my early days and dreams and aspirations also to go and do kind of sort of an engineering systems engineer role, advance in that career to then transition into business ownership. So what was kind of that? So then you've written this essay. Are you going to college? What are you going to college for? What was that first engineer's role?
Yeah. So college was a wild set of turns. So the first turn was when I was 18 years old, I was playing video games with my sister, and we're playing on like whatever little console, I don't know, Nintendo or something. And the phone rings. And I thought it was a football coach that wanted to recruit me to Haverford, which is a beautiful school. Haverford's very nice, but it wasn't my Dream School, right? So I had the phone it like kind of crooked against my ear, and I'm continuing to play video games, and I'm answering the coach like kind of like only a punk 18-year-old can. And the coach says to me, says, well, son, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm getting the impression that you're just not that interested in Harvard. And I just flipped the control, like the TV off, and dropped the controller. My sister starts yelling at me, and I'm like, shut up. And I'm like, no, coach, I'm very interested in Harvard. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God, this is the biggest phone call I've ever got in my life. And I blew it because I thought he said Haverford. And oh my, so I resuscitated that conversation real quick. My attitude got shipped straight. And that coach turned out to be a wonderful mentor. And we laugh about that day, but what wound up happening was I got recruited to play football at Harvard. And so that was extraordinary. Went on, played, I lasted 2 weeks, and then I ripped my Achilles tendon straight in half. Just rolled up like a Venetian blind. I know that's gross, but it was a rough injury. Ended my career 2 weeks into my freshman year at Harvard. And then I wound up taking classes at Harvard and MIT, kind of balancing both engineering and engineering management between the two schools. And I had a blast. But during the summers when I was in college, I went home and I worked in my uncle and my dad. They had a factory, a Detroit heavy metal bending, smoke coming out of the tinted thing, heavy duty mass production industry. And I loved it. I loved everything that we made there. We made all kinds of parts for the heartbeat of America, man. We made rapid tension bolts, and we made piston pins, and we made all kinds of other random odds and ends that you would not imagine. It was a big industrial thing, and I loved it. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I'm going to be a mechanical engineer. I'm going to follow in my dad and my uncle's footsteps. I'm going to start working in their business out of college. I'm basically going to be Tommy Boy. It's basically what that comes down to. And I'll never forget this. The last curve in that college career is it's midway through my senior year. I've got 3-4 years of engineering experience and intern experience. I know everything there is to know about this plant that you can know by the time you're 21 years old. And my dad knocks on the door, and I'm like, where'd you come from? And he said, I wanted to fly in and I wanted to talk to you. And I said, okay, what are we talking about? And he said, you can't come work at the factory. And I said, why not? And he said, because it's not right for you. I'm going to sell it, at some point, and you're like going to be a mid-level manager, and then you're going to work for whoever we sell it to. And when that happens, all this stuff that you've built, all this kind of capability, it's not going to work. So find something else. And I was kind of spellbound. I was like, my God, my career is over before it started. I'm 21 years old. I have no plan, no idea of what to do, because I had a plan and it just blew up in my face, right?
This sounds so like it's happened twice to you, kind of.
This has happened. Yeah, this is kind of like, this happens, so.
And I get that, but also like, I want to rewind to Harvard a little bit, because you said within your first couple weeks. Which that's kind of a radical, help me out here. I mean, I'm wrong, but I feel like it's like, all right, college football, Harvard, you're there, we're 2 weeks into what could be a dream come true for some folks, and bam.
Yep. And now you're a tripod with your leg pointed down in a cast for 10 weeks and it takes you a year to run without a limp. Yeah. No. So it was
a year to run without a limp. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was.
Well, what's going through your head through that, man? Because I'm going to get pretty freaking depressed. You seem to think, you seem to, at least in this moment, I could understand why it might feel that way, but you seem to, as if it were nothing.
Here's the thing. I remember being 18 at the time, and I had the same feeling then that I have now, which is you do what you can with what you have, right? And so one of my favorite exercises when I'm totally feeling overwhelmed is to imagine I just parachuted into the body of this person named David G. Ewing, and I'm taking over today. Like, today's my first day, And then when I do that and I kind of wipe the slate clean, it lets me really categorize, well, what do I have going for me, And when you're 18 years old, you've got your foot in a cast, but you're at Harvard, that's not such a bad place to be. I think a lot of people would be like, yeah, tear my Achilles tendon, I'll go to Harvard.
They got to owe you a little bit, right? It's not like you just lost whatever scholarship or whatever you had, or did you?
No,
I don't know.
No. That's a really it was not a scholarship situation. I had the ability to keep going there. I'm now at like the world's greatest university, some might say. I don't want to get too arrogant or cocky. It's a wonderful place. I've got access to all these professors. I mean, that when I was tripodding around as a freshman, I went and met with my chemistry professor and was like, hey, so how did you become a professor at Harvard? And he said, well, you know, I discovered the ozone hole over the Antarctic and da 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 da. And like, and I was like, you're the guy? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, how did that happen? And so, you know, those are the kinds of people that are your professors, and they're fascinating to meet. And it was a wonderful, cool experience. So, you know, yeah, it was a huge upset that one door closed, but another door opened, you know, and I was able to do things that I couldn't have done otherwise. And so it was an extraordinary opportunity. And you know, I just took stock of it and was like, well, what if you parachuted into the body of an 18-year-old Harvard student who's got a torn Achilles tendon? I don't know. It's kind of an interesting place to be. And that's kind of the attitude that I had. And so I made do with what I had, and it worked out okay, you know? And so, you know, that's how I handle everything, is make do with what you got, you know? And so getting back to being 22, there I am, career's blown up.
Yeah.
But what do I have? Well, I've got a degree from Harvard in engineering with all this knowledge and all this excitement and a lot of practical experience from some great internships. So what I did
Looking back, do you think that was the right call? I mean, it sounds like the right call in 2020 retrospect on dad, but I mean, do you still think that was a good call?
I mean, you know, I try not to go, when I deal with regrets and like looking backwards in time, I try to only focus on what are the lessons I learned, not what if. Because what ifs are pointless, right? What if that didn't happen? What if I did go there? Forget it. It didn't happen. But what do I learn about that situation? Well, I had all my eggs in one basket. Was that such a good idea? No. Mm. So that's the lesson, is maybe
in the future. And it wasn't your basket.
Wasn't my basket. There was a lot more outside of my control than was inside my control. And you know what? When that happens, learn the lesson. So learn the lesson and forget the what ifs. Not that, you know, to be honest, nobody can get rid of every what if, but I try not to do that because that part is the waste of time. Learn the lesson, move on. So, you know, so what I did was I went down to Harvard Square and was like, well, let's go buy a copy of Pop Mechanics and Pop Science and see what's on the cover. Maybe I can call them up and see what's going on. And I did. And that led to a whole series of adventures of me learning about, you know, different people. And I almost signed up with this charlatan who was on the cover of Pop Mechanics. I'll never forget this. This guy wanted to build a ship that was going to be 2 miles long. And he called it the Freedom Ship. And he wanted to make it a tax haven for the most wealthy individuals to have the ship that they could, you know, circle the globe on and take off on the runway on the top. And it was on the cover of Pop Mechanics. I thought it was the coolest thing. So I reached out to him. It turned out like that thing was going nowhere. So I didn't ultimately do that, but I wound up going to a venture capital company in Silicon Valley out of college. And that's only because I didn't, you know, go back to Detroit and work in manufacturing. And so, you know, it turned out to be great. And that's how my career got started, was that I was in the middle of the 90s and, or late 90s at that point. And, you know, in Silicon Valley, when the dot-com thing was blowing up, like you wouldn't believe. And you know what? That's a pretty great place to be. So, you know, started my career there.
At a venture capital firm, which that's a little bit different. That's not quite engineering. That's a beeline. That's a fun beeline, I feel like. But tell me about that one.
So the interesting thing about that place is that it was a boutique firm that did two things. It had venture capital, and then it did consulting, hands-on, boots-on-the-ground consulting for the companies it invested in. And so I was part of the consulting team. I was not a venture capitalist. And so I got my experience working with like some of the best names in Silicon Valley, who either hired us just for our consulting skills or were a startup that we had backed. And I was there, you know, with the VP of marketing trying to figure out, you know, how to get the first couple customers. And so that was a really awesome experience because I think my hang up with consulting in general is when it's too arm wavy and too much like, I built you an Excel model, aren't I so smart? Like, there's nothing wrong with those Excel models, but it wasn't going to be the thing that I think fulfilled my needs. I wanted to be far more operational. And so what was really unique about that company was called RB Weber, was RB Weber was, you know, this really group of really bright people from Harvard, MIT, Stanford, and Yale, who were all focused on trying to help these venture capital startups, you know, make it to the next level to improve the venture fund. And that was an extraordinarily cool thing to learn and to do. And so that's kind of where I got into tech. It's where I got into enterprise software. It's where I really learned a lot more about, you know, the things that I do today was all through, you know, that early experience in those first couple years with RB Weber.
Mm, that's very exciting. Fantastic. And then kind of tell me about, so at this point, is at this career even, you've been a few places, right? Remind me, where did you grow up? And what had you just kind of like, now we're over in Silicon Valley. Now we're, I mean, this is, you're going after the opportunity, which is a fantastic thing, but I don't think everybody ends up in that boat. Is it almost just kind of luck that you're like, hey, here's the opportunity. I'm here now. I mean, that's where it's at. I'm going to go there. Or were you just kind of always traveling?
So I've wound up living at all four points of the compass, north, south, east, and west. And so I started in the north. I grew up in Detroit. You know, that's where I got all the manufacturing experience. And then went to school out east in Boston and, you know, got to live there for college. And then what happened during my junior year of college is I got a call from this aunt that was my mom's sister that I barely knew at the time. And she said, David, I don't know you. You don't know me. If we don't figure this out and get to know each other now, we never will. So why don't you come out here for spring break? So I went out to San Francisco as a junior in college and got to meet my aunt and her husband, my uncle, great people, and got to explore. And when I came back from that trip, I came back and said, the only place I ever want to live is San Francisco. It is so unbelievable. I mean, San Francisco in the 1990s, you couldn't touch it. It was just so spectacular, right? And so I when I got free, actually, I thought of it as getting freed up from having to go back to Detroit to go work in manufacturing. I applied for, you know, pretty much only things in Silicon Valley and San Francisco. And that's how I kind of landed there. So that's it. So then I lived on the West Coast and now I live in Austin. So north, south, east, west, I kind of covered all four. So that's really kind of how that came to be.
Wow. Yeah. That's exciting. I just got back from Beverly Hills. That was my first time over there.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely beautiful, beautiful weather. So what drove you out of the VC thing into the next thing?
You know, the company was magnificent in terms of the opportunity to learn. And, you know, I'd say the advice that I read from someone else later that I happened to just unconsciously do is I picked a job where I could learn something. And that was a job that it just taught me so much about business, about strategy, about technology, about marketing, about customer penetration, pricing models, like you name it. Like I was learning just like bits and pieces here and there. And, you know, the thing is I was really itching to say, all right, I've now kind of done this from sort of the sidelines where I'm, you know, a part of this, but not really. Like, I mean, I'm a consultant. I'm not an operator, right? And I really wanted to operate. Yeah. So one of the partners from RB Weber had left and started a tech startup, and it just was bad timing, right? Like they started a tech startup in the year 1999. Was it 99 or 2000? I can't remember. Anyway, they started this tech startup and then, you know, the venture capital community just dried up, you know, and we hit that dot-com nuclear winter when everything imploded and that company imploded as well. So, it was February of 2001 when that company imploded, and I was kind of left with a week of severance and kind of, you know, a really big payment for my apartment in San Francisco, and like most 20 somethings, I didn't exactly save a lot of money, you know, so I was kind of, you know, to be blunt, kind of desperate to try to figure out, well, what am I going to do next, and so I had the dream of starting a software company, but there was no tech funding. So I went to angel investors and friends and family, and they all turned me down. They were like, absolutely not. No way. Nothing. So I was sitting there talking to my dad, and I was like, I don't know what to do. And the phone rang, and it was someone from my network who said, hey, I heard that you are down and out. Would you like to consult for us? And I looked at my dad, and I was like, I don't know, it seems like a sign. And he was like, yeah. And so we started San Francisco Consulting Group the next day. I started it. I was cash flow positive on day one with my first customer. The phone rang twice more that week, and I had three customers by the end of the week. And I started my company. And it was a, you know, kind of doing what I'd been doing before, but like a little bit more of an operator type angle. And you know, I grew it from there. So I hired my first employee on September 10th, 2001, the day before 9/11. And so 9/11 hits the next day. And I'm sitting there going, holy smokes, I now have an employee. I've got payroll to make. This is quite a moment. So it was a real gut check moment of to whether I just fold right there and say, that's it. I'm going to go join, you know, the 10th Mountain or something and, you know, try to get some payback. Or I'm going to keep going on this one and, you know, try to make this thing go. And my thinking at the time was I really underestimated what was going to happen in the 2000s. I just really felt like the idea of stopping and serving the country was going to be a waste of time because I felt like it was going to be over in like a day. I was like, you know, a couple Tomahawk missiles, these guys are gone and this is over. So instead of shutting the business down, I thought, well, we're fighting terrorism.
Probably and I the think best that was the general sentiment too, to be fair.
It was
to
the
you.
General I mean, sentiment. That, I really felt like I underestimated what was going to happen. And so I
was
didn't
talking to
stop
a buddy of mine that was one of the initial ones. I mean, he seems to know at least a lot. I think he was one of the initial ones over there. And he talks about it. He's like, man, that the actual like paid supposed militia hadn't been fed for weeks. We roll in and they're raising their hands. We give up. Like it was the Saddam's forces were. And so even in the initial, right, I to your credit, I don't think it took too long before that was the early opinion of that.
Yeah. So Afghanistan, I just felt like we were going to roll right through them. Yep. And we didn't, obviously.
And then you're going to wonder what you're going to do after that. So you're right back in the same boat.
So I decided to stick with it and, you know, and tough it out. And so 2002 is a pretty lean year for me in 03. But I met my wife in 03, or at late 02 and, fell in love with her. So, you know, then we were, you know, kind of off to the races there. What, the business started taking off and we started growing. So
what made it lean exactly? Was it just nobody's thinking about business here right now, we're all thinking about over there? What I mean, do you think, because you definitely seem to have these related, and yet they don't seem related in my head, so I'm trying to understand.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that, you know, when something crazy like 9/11 or the pandemic or other things happen, you know, everybody gets really nervous. Nobody starts an investment spree at that point, right? I mean, everybody kind of clams up and hunkers down. So the amount of companies that were available to me to market to through 2002 was extraordinarily limited. And quite frankly, I took any contract I could find. So, you know, here I am thinking I'm going to have this company that consults to the Fortune 500 or tech startups or other things that I knew about. Those guys were not investing a dime and they weren't looking to grow. Everybody was hunkered down. So I wound up finding contracts with, like, you know, a local yoga studio. I was working for this wonderful yoga studio in San Francisco, or, you know, a guy who had an idea to put on business seminars. And I would take just about anybody that year as a client and try to do the best I could for them. And, you know, I made a lot of people, a lot of small businesses, a lot of money that year. But I was charging, you know, extremely lean fees. So yeah, it was an extremely hard scrabble start to get everything going. So, definitely quite a tough time, but, you know, we climbed out of that and as 03 turned into 04, you know,
what a shrewd yoga studio.
It was really fun. You know, we did a lot of cool things that I don't see other yoga studios ever do. Like, here's a simple one. If you're a yoga studio out there, I don't know why you don't do this. You know, people come into the yoga studio and there's no semblance of how they place their mats. Everybody's got mats and some are close together, some are far apart, some are forward, some are back. It's just a mess, right? And the reality is that you can pack more people into a studio if you just lay out where the mats are supposed to go on the floor so that they're nice and staggered, so that when I reach out my arms to both sides, I might be over the other two mats, but they're staggered. So I'm not, clicking, clacking with my two colleagues on either side, right? Just stuff like that. And so we got the density up because these guys had they were oversubscribed and we were able to increase capacity. And I mean, it's just little stuff like that. But, you know, just, you know, I kind of came up with that idea as I was taking one of their classes and we were like, oh, yeah, this is great. Now there's these nice little tags on the ground stickers and people just place their mats just so. And it's perfectly lined up every time. So anyway, it was stuff like that. But so that was those were some of the earlier wins stuff, fun stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, yeah, go ahead, Sam.
So you'll forgive me. I feel like I have the question that could help somebody. Cause I feel like if I'm a yoga studio and it's nothing against you, you're a very, very smart person. But if somebody's like, hey, you should maybe consider hiring a consultant, they might be able to help bring in more business. Transparently, just with your experience, it's not like you're the first person to kind of come to my mind. So here's the question, and let alone a yoga studio in general. I mean, if I own a yoga studio, you're coming to me like, maybe you should hire a consultant. I'm like, what, to consult on what? I'm a yoga studio. We lay down mats and we do these exercises and like, what should I raise prices? I don't need a consultant to tell me that. So here's the question, right? Let's think into the mind of the yoga studio and these types of businesses, my own type of business. You know, there's people listening. At what point, I mean, should you always be engaging with a consultant? What should you be engaging with consultants on? Like, this is your opportunity to kind of be a voice for. There's plenty of consultants and coaches and out there, right? And every single one of them are kind of like, I can help you make your business better. And that's what every owner wants, right? Yeah, I want a better business. Fantastic. How do you know when to engage and with what?
Great question, because for every success, there's somebody else who hired a consultant who overrepresented their skills and got burned and is really salty about that. So, you know, it's a little bit of a grab bag. I'll tell you how I landed that yoga studio. Was there was a handyman working on the roof who overheard me on the phone pitching what I did. And he came in and looked in the window and was like, hey, my wife has a yoga studio and what you're talking about sounds pretty good. Would you like to meet her? And I was like, yes, I would. So that's how I got that client. And we worked on it from there. But, you know, I would say that, you know, here's a story that I had. I hired a woman to be my executive coach when I was in my 30s. And I needed help to kind of take my business to the next level. I couldn't figure out why it wasn't going there. And I hired her and she was wonderful. She had a system. She did all these really interesting personality diagnostics. She worked with me to try to unpack like some of my mental hangups and really get out of my own way. And, you know, she taught me a lot about mental modeling and all this stuff. And after 6 months, I felt like a new person, and I definitely felt like I was wearing someone else's clothes, but I felt like a new person and I started to behave in different ways. And I said to her, I said, you know, this is so great. What's next? Like, what else can we do together? And she's like, we can meet every month. And so for another 6 months we met, but nowhere near the same effect, same person, same skill set, but now over her skis because she's passed the system that she did. So while I got a little bit of value from the thing, it was nothing like the transformative 6 months I got from her and her system. So I think that, you know, if you're someone out there and you're like, do I hire a consultant or not? I wouldn't necessarily think just about who is this person, someone I can trust? Is this person smart? But do they have a system, right? And so when I went to that yoga studio, I applied a system that helped them identify and come up with their pain points and decision making things, and we innovated together. But that's really where I was able to make such a good effect on them. But I think that too many consultants are come to this, and I just met a couple the other day who pitched me on some stuff, and they're like, "We're really smart, you know, we can figure things out." And I'm like, "Yeah, you're really smart. I'm sure you can figure things out. I'm really smart. I can figure things out. Do you have a system? Do you have a tool? Do you have some assets? Like, what do you have that's going to like really give us an outsized gain here? Because you can feed it into your system, or, you know, you can do something. And in a short period of time, you're going to deliver something that I could never do with just other smart people." That I think is what really differentiates a really wonderful opportunity with someone who is an advisor from the outside, from someone who's just a smart folks that'll listen and help you out. You know, that's really basically just a temporary employee. And if that's what you need, I guess that's fine. you know?
No, it's a good point too, because it I mean, it's the standard question for me for like marketing and sales firms in general too, right? That are, it's kind of like, okay, well, what's the period of time in which we need to invest a certain amount of money? How much are we investing and what's the theoretical return, right? And it's not like we're expecting it to be perfect, but to your point exactly, and you're welcome to check me here, but this is my measurement, my gauge for exactly what you're saying, which is, do they have a system? Because if they do have a system, then those questions should be more easily answered in a way that's like, okay, well, obviously I don't have a magic wand or ball, but we should be able to do this. This should happen. And then that, and then that, and then done. And then we'd look at it and measure it over 3-6 months. And we have our results.
Yeah. Well, I would say that it looks more like this, is that, you know, everyone wants a result. Everyone wants an outcome. But when you hire people, you know, the outcome is great, but it's not a guarantee, right? Nobody can guarantee victory on anything at any time. There's just, we've all seen way too many curveballs that the world's going to throw you, let alone, things that can happen inside your company and so forth. So the thing that I find to be far more reliable and promising is there a process, and will going through the process by itself benefit us? Right? Because if you go through a process, that is guaranteed. We're going to definitely go through the process. And if the process yields results because it gives us insight and advantages, regardless of whether, you know, the lead generation company promised us 50 leads a month, that may not happen. But if the lead generation company can really help you sharpen your articulated sales message and, you know, help you find new channels and mediums, then whether the economy turns to sand or not, you've got those skills. You've got something for it, and you'll get the result in its due time. And so that's typically what I look for, is the process itself going to bring value, or is the process itself just the process and we're hoping for this pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, in which case it's not the thing.
Interesting. So I'm almost hearing a gauge of like, am I going to learn something?
At the end of the day, that is really the only competitive advantage, right? Is your leadership team, is your company going to gain new core competencies it didn't have before? If it does, you're off to the races. If it doesn't, I don't know how great that was. It's more just like an employee, you know?
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. So to dive back in, you're moving out of, hopefully, so 2002, 2003, you said you met your wife at the end of 2002, and these are, it's a down period for the business. You're taking on anything and you're doing great stuff for real small businesses at a great rate for that small business. They're turning stuff around and hopefully referring you to other folks, although maybe not the ideal clients you expected, which were Fortune 500 and big tech startups.
Yep. And that lasted kind of through 2003. And into 2004, as we started to build a brand for ourselves, we started to get word of mouth, we started to, you know, figure out our own marketing, and we did that. And so 2003, 2004, we built that up. What happened in 2005 was really interesting. And that was the first time I discovered SaaS software, software as a service. And I discovered it because I just needed to buy something to track. I had a sales guy at that point, and I needed to track, what are you working on all day? And, you know, I looked at Salesforce. They were, you know, a brand new startup themselves at that time. And then, you know, their stuff was expensive. And then there was an alternative product from Oracle. And I wound up going with the Oracle product. And then I implemented it myself. And I thought, you know, this is a really great piece of technology. And what I like about it is it's more focused on the analytics, which was always weak in Salesforce. And, and I said, you know, this kind of is like strategy every day. You know, it's like if we can give people the intel on their business because they have dashboards and reports and other things that can tell them where they're weak and where they're strong, then they can take action immediately and they can run their company more effectively. And so we partnered with Oracle. And what's interesting is Oracle was behind Salesforce. And so they were far more open to a flea-bitten little company like mine than they were to trying to get the next Accenture to pay attention to them. And so we started the partnership. And so 2005, 2006, and 2007 was really me taking everything that I'd learned and codifying it into systems and technology, and not just, you know, a process that was just on paper and pencil. And so that became really successful. And what really turned the corner in 2008 was, you know, Oracle had decided to do a roadshow to compete with Salesforce. And they put an APB out to all their partners to say, do you have any customers in the following cities? And they listed a bunch of cities. And I contacted them back with my list of customers. I really didn't talk to them very much. I just implemented their software and that was kind of it. And I got a phone call and somebody said, wait a minute, you have a happy customer in every single one of these cities that we want to do a roadshow? And I'm like, kind of just shrugged and was like, yeah, you know. And he said, we don't have any other partners who can even give us one. Who are you? And I said, well, okay. And so we started to get to know one another. And that's when I kind of got catapulted immediately from this obscure partner that Oracle just signed a piece of paper with to, you know, a lighthouse partner that Oracle wanted to tout to their biggest customers. And so I went overnight from working with, you know, small companies that were, you know, couple, you know, less than 10 million in revenue to 50 million in revenue, somewhere in there, to working with Fortune 500 companies again. And I knew how to handle myself in those situations. I'd done that before. And so then we really started to take off. And so, you know, through the next period of time, you know, that's really what happened. And that rise happened all the way to 2011, when I decided to relocate the company to Texas. So it had been called San Francisco Consulting Group up to that point. And we decided we needed to leave California. And so we relocated to Austin, because Austin was where the Oracle data center was located. And so we went there thinking that people, in those days, people still wanted to kind of tour the cloud, right? They wanted to go see where their data was located. And we're like, well, that's great. We'll be right next to that location. And when people want to come visit, you know, they can visit with us at the same time. And that's how we made the choice to come to Austin. So that was it. It was before Oracle relocated their entire company here and made it their headquarters. They were still in Redwood Shores at the time. So we got here first. And so that was how that began. And so then we doubled down and continued to expand that practice and built all kinds of integrations and extensions and other technologies. And so, you know, that has been something that we've steadily grown until we were a premier partner for Oracle in our niche, the customer experience niche, and focused on lifetime value. So that really, you know, is a long decade between 08 and 18 or 19. But that was everything that happened to us pre-pandemic, you know. So it was quite a ride.
How did it feel first getting back into those Fortune 500 companies? Oracle makes those first initial couple introductions. Do you remember them?
Yeah, well, I do. I do. And I can't tell you who they were, because they were financial services companies, and I'm still under lock and key on all of them. But it was amazing, because, you know, at that point, we had a team that was extraordinarily skilled in the technology, but was definitely rough around the edges when it came to professional demeanor that you'd expect from a corporation, right? So, so just in terms of making sure we filled out the right forms and gave them the right documents, we had a pretty big learning curve through that decade to try to button up our operation and become far more of a corporate player. So there were definitely some gaffes along the way, but you know, we managed to pull that all together through that decade and got that to the point where our quality and our systems and our processes and documentation and all that stuff were up to snuff with what a corporate customer would expect. And so that was a pretty big learning curve, and I'd say that continues to this day, because there's really no end to that. And in a good way, I'm talking about like just making sure you've got good controls and processes in place and that you are doing things, because over these last 20 years, the stakes have risen, right? The amount of technical onslaught, phishing attacks, you know, security attacks, they've just gotten, you know, exponentially more aggressive than they were back in the day. And so, you know, you could be a little bit fast and loose back in the day. But you know, those days are long past us. And so with all of that, you know, making sure that you have the proper, procedures in place, just so that nothing is exposed. There's no chinks in the armor anywhere where anybody could get access to any piece of data, ever, without, you know, it having authorization. Those are, essential skills that, you know, just weren't required in such nearly as much demand, with nowhere near the catastrophic consequences, that they have now. So that's really been kind of the biggest innovation.
No kidding. Yeah. Yep. It's a wild thing too. You know, when you hear about big companies like LastPass getting hacked because one of their developers logs in from a home computer and has an unpatched Plex server that had a hacker chilling in the background on that then leaps over to their computer that then gets access to their every vault. Like it's a wild thing, right? Because it's like it's that small thing of I mean, it comes back to the trust aspect, right? It's like you trusted that person. They were probably a lead developer. I mean, they had access to every environment, right? And on kind of a whim, they're logging in from their home computer. They probably need to do a patch, something like that. I don't know. I'm adding a little bit to the story here. I don't know the full thing. Don't quote me, anybody. But we do know that it was their home environment. It was an unsecured computer, and it was a scenario where an unpatched Plex server is ultimately how the hacker got in and over. And so it is kind of a wild world there. It's like ransomware isn't as near. I mean, it's a big concern, but it's like them getting in is where we need to stop them.
You know, back in 2017, I'll never forget, I read this book, American Kingpin. I don't know if you ever read American Kingpin, but it's the story of the hunt for Ross Ulbricht, the guy who created the Silk Road, that real dark web, you know, site where you could buy drugs order assassinations all sorts of horrible stuff.
We're going
back. It
was
a dark.
Yeah.
Yes. So that was 2017 when that book came out, and they'd caught him at that point, right? And how did they catch him? And I'm going to gloss over the technical details, but essentially Ross was super careful to always be locked down, anonymous, unable to be found. And the FBI caught just a whiff of his signature from a cafe in Glen Park in San Francisco for a quarter of a second. That's it. That's all it took. And it was just because I think he'd done his order of operations slightly wrong and was on the Wi-Fi at the cafe, and they got him. And, you know, that's all it takes is, and when I listened to that and realized, wow, like obviously the hackers in this case were the good guys, the FBI, but they got that guy because of some tiny infinitesimal mistake. And that was my big wake-up call into security to be like, wow, there are so many vulnerabilities. And when you're dealing with people's, you know, our customers trust that when we're loading data into their systems or transferring things or integrating things, it's got to be bolted down with the highest level of security. And, you know, it just takes that tiny little slip and things can get magnified way, way out of proportion.
Yeah. I agree. It's a wild world, for sure. It's an unrelated thing, but I was just talking to a security guy the other day about how, and this is like, it's related but not, but it's just, it goes to show you, it plays into the whole like, why, that's so weird and you never would have considered it. We brought up Roblox. We started talking about Roblox. I'm hoping to maybe have him on the podcast. And he was talking about how he's like, yeah, but it gets even worse than that. He's like, people are using Roblox as human experiments. He's like, we've ran into scenarios where adults have been getting on and grooming children to go into their classroom and commit mass stabbings. And it's just through this iterative. I mean, you think about it, the mind of a kid, and I put my, you know, I've got a little 4-year-old, right? She's a smart little kid, but she's also in this position mentally where it's like, mom and dad know everything. If you're an adult and you walk up and you say XYZ, like that's the gospel truth in her book, right? I mean, at the point to where she's coming home with all these questions, like, why this, mom? Why that? Oh, some people don't believe XYZ. I don't understand why don't they believe that? I mean, at one point she's literally like, we were going into a conversation about different religions, and she's like, oh, they're lying. I'm like, well, that's nuance. Are they lying if they don't believe it? They don't understand? Like, they don't. And so anyway, I don't know. It's this weird element of like, even if you lock down the technology, right? Have you accounted for the human core aspect? And then you know, it's like, it's always the one thing, like you're saying exactly, that infinitesimal slip, right? And so then it's like, how do we account for that? How do we stay nimble enough while strict enough, that happy medium where we can be prepped for the totally unexpected.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, sorry. I brought it dark fast. Okay, and then we're caught up now, I think, for the most part. This is very exciting. That's cool. And your wife's been with you through all of it, through the down in 03.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, we met standing on the street in San Francisco, and I just struck up a conversation with her. And when we went on our first date, we didn't know anything about each other. So she sat down and, you know, she was definitely jaded to the dating scene. And so she sits down and kind of sighs and is like, so where are you from? And I said, no, we're not doing this. I don't know anything about you and you don't know anything about me. And instead of making a bunch of small talk, I have in my mind this idea of who you are and I want to guess and see if I'm right. And then I want you to guess about me. And she's like, okay. She's like, I'll go first. And she guessed about me and she was exactly correct. Like everything and then I had all these things that I guessed about her and nothing was correct. I was wrong on just about everything. And so it was a fun way to begin a blind date that turned out to be, you know, a romance and a lifelong marriage. So yeah, it's been really cool.
That's pretty smooth. That's a pretty smooth, because even if you fall flat on your face, that's just kind of fun.
Sort of charming, yeah, to be a complete idiot. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, no, it was great. So yeah, so we met and it was really wonderful. So cool story. But yeah, she's been with me the whole time, every up, every down. We've done some wild things and had a great time. So it's not easy being married to me, but she's managed to make it a core competency, and she's quite good at it.
What are some of the things that, so back rewinding a little bit to the venture capital scene, what are some, and the consulting, you know, you've been in quite a few businesses. What's something relatively consistent that you've seen that you're like, man, if I could wave a magic wand, this would fix like 75, 80, 90% of businesses. And maybe they're just so radically difficult that doesn't. But if you had one thing that you're like, man, I'm tired of seeing this in every single firm, if they just fix this thing.
You know, I think it is the constant willingness of mass psychosis around whatever the theme of the day is. So, you know, for me, you know, back in 2001, it was the new economy, right? And it was all about eyeballs and people. And, you know, you can defy gravity for a short period of time and then it came crashing down, right? Then it was 2008 and it was like, oh, it's real estate and, you know, it's arms and they'll go forever and there'll never be any consequences. And then it comes crashing down. And then, you know, the pandemic happens and everyone's like, it's going to be bad forever. We'll never go to a restaurant again. And then, of course, that completely falls apart. And then now it's like, it's AI and it's all about AI and it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's profit and loss and balance statement. It's liability, it's cash, and it's assets. And that never changes. It's always an advantage to have a lower cost. It is always advantage to be able to price at a premium. It is always advantage to extend customers and to have long-term contracts. Like these things, these fundamental principles never change. They're always there. And it's not eyeballs and it's not AI and it's not arms and it's none of those things. It's always the same things. And so when you can really zero in on, do I have a cost advantage? You win. And when you don't, you lose. And it's that simple.
I like it. That's a good note, man. Is there anything else in particular we've missed on? I've got a couple standardized questions I like to end on, but before I move to that point, I want to make sure we've,
you know, there's two
there's
things
so much
that I
more
think
I could ask you on, but yeah,
you know, I think there's two things that I've learned along the way that I think are things that I wish somebody had told me. One is, and I'll give you the source. It's from The Subtle Art of Not Giving Enough, and it's chapter two, and it's one of the greatest chapters of any book I've ever read in my life. And the gist of the chapter says this, you know, when you ask, like, what are you dreaming about? What do you want? And everybody's dream looks something like this. I want a lot of money. You know, I want to look great. I want to go to the club and I want everybody to be like, there he is. There's the guy, you know, high five. And you know what? That's you and everybody else. You, me, and guess what? That by itself does not make you special. Your great ambition does not make you special at all. Because we're all the same. What makes you special is the price you're willing to pay.
because some people are willing to go to the mats and are willing to, you know, take nights and weekends and sacrifice vacations and, you know, do the things that nobody else wants to do because that's the price they're willing to pay. And that is what makes you special. Not what you want, but what you're willing to give. That, I think, is one thing that I found when I read that book. It's been something that's just ironclad in me. And it's like, what's the price you're willing to pay? Because I never complain about the external factors and what happens. It happens to everybody sooner or later. Everybody gets an up or they get it down. They get a break. They get a tough break. What price are you willing to pay? The second thing that I really has been amazing is through Entrepreneurs Organization, I was in Miami. And I was at an event with the South Florida chapter, and they had this woman, Molly Bloom, come talk to them. Molly made a tour. I don't know if you ever had a chance to meet Molly, but Molly had a tough break. She was an Olympic skier. She was getting ready for her time trial to qualify to go to the Olympics, and a tiny little blade of a tree was just sticking up somewhere, and it flipped her binding just as she was going onto a ramp. And her ski came off and she flipped over 17 different times and landed on her back and broke her back. She went on, and if you've ever seen the movie Molly's Game, which is a really great movie, she went on to go run this like international poker game, and she got arrested for racketeering before she made the movie and all this stuff. So she had this crazy second half to her life. But what I was really interested in was the Olympic part, because she made a second attempt after her back healed. And when I got there, I asked her, I was like, Molly, how did you get back out there? Like, how did you get back on the hill knowing you just broke your back from this tiny little fluke? You know, and she said that her dad was her coach. And as she started to get back into the time trials and starting to compete again, she said, Dad, there's this voice in my head and it says, your binding's going to come off again. You're going to break your back. It's going to happen again. It happened once. It can happen again. What do I do about this voice, Dad? And he said, there's nothing wrong with having a voice. The only thing that's wrong is if you don't talk back to it. And I have found that too often in life, I'm sitting there and I have this voice and it's like, you didn't go fast enough. That marketing program you put together wasn't good enough. The solution you delivered to that customer, it wasn't the best you could possibly do. You were late to get some process implemented, on and on and on. It's constantly there and it's constantly criticizing me. But I have learned from Molly that I also have to talk back to that. Be like, no, actually, we did do a great job. That was the best we could do. We did have a pretty good marketing campaign. We did get leads. We did, like, things did go right. Like, it's not all to the bad. And I realized that I was robbing myself of joy by having that constant criticism of myself. And it was ultimately ruining my life. Because no matter how successful anything was, there was always that voice telling me it wasn't good enough. And I've learned through a lot of patience to actually have a conversation with myself and to refute those negative ideas and make sure that I understand the positive. And that's been a huge game changer. So now I'm done, Sam. That's it. That's all I got.
That's beautiful, man. Well, I don't know. You might have lied. I mean, I think you've lined it up perfectly for the questions. Some of them you may have already kind of answered. So the first one is, we've got a saying that goes, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life, David, that you would like to pay homage to in this moment?
Oh, that is a long list. I had, going back, of course, my parents, both of them were entrepreneurs, and both of them kind of taught me the lesson that says you can pick any career you want, but there's a range on salary. It goes from X to Y. If you ever just want to be unbounded and really go for something amazing, entrepreneur or nothing. And I thought that was a really cool early insight that kind of inculcated the entrepreneurial spirit in me. I've had tremendous coaches in high school. The football coach that I had just passed away a few months ago, he had fifth winningest coach in Michigan history. 5 decades worth of NFL football players that he had sent in. I mean, just an amazing, amazing guy. But he didn't give a damn about football. And he never cared about the score and was just one of those people that was like, if you're a good person, I'll talk to you. And if you're not, you're useless to me. And it just taught me a lot about life at a formative age, especially how to treat women. You know, he introduced his wife to me once when we were in the stands watching one of our competitors play. And he introduced her and said, David, I want you to meet my best friend. This is my wife, Phyllis. And I just remember being like, wow, that's a tremendous attitude to have towards her. And his level of respect for her and kindness was something that was really healthy for me to see at an age when, you know, we were trying to all be tough and, you know, kind of being alpha. And it changed my life for the better. I've had business mentors. I had a guy who for just 3 months was employed at RB Weber with me. And for 3 months, this guy taught me a tremendous amount. And I learned more from him in 3 months than I did from all the other partners over the entire time I was there. I've had tremendous advisors. My investors in Content Lion are some of the finest people I've ever met. And they've been extraordinary and have been just tremendous in terms of helping me make sure that we see clearly to navigate around problems, and they're wonderful. So yeah, I mean, I would say that, there's absolutely no way I would ever claim that, that any of the success I've had has had anything to do with me alone. Because every single time I've had success, it has always been a team. It has always been a group of people that are extraordinary. And I just am grateful for all of them.
So the second, thank you. And the second question is, if you had one pithy saying or general rule of thumb that you've found to be true again and again and again in your life, what would it be?
I have a couple. Some are jokes and some are not. So the one that's a joke is I love to look at my kids and say, it's like I planned it that way. And that has a couple of different meanings. One is when something completely lucky happens and it comes out of nowhere. And I say that, they know that I was a complete fluke. But other times, like when I had set them up and I do know what I'm talking about and they're kind of astounded that the old man knows what's going on, it always kind of like makes them laugh. But I say it in both contexts. And I get an eye roll every time with, it's like I planned it that way. So that's my jokey one. The one that I think is the one that like I think has the more grit and is better is I always say that life is 10% what happens to me and 90% how I react to it. And I believe that it has been a lifelong thing. I read it when I was, I think, back in high school, and I've always decided to embody that. And you know, the reaction that I have to any stimulus and the choice that I make there is so much more important than what the original event ever was. And I just have found that there's a lot more inside my sphere of control than I ever realized. And so I really try to adapt and grab onto the things that I can control and identify as many things as I can. Because I think that especially in the most desperate of circumstances, there's still much more than you can control than you realize, and every little bit helps. And so I found that by seizing on that, I've gotten myself out of some sticky situations.
Love it. Thank you, David. I've really enjoyed having you on today.
Sam, this has been a really, really fun podcast. Thank you so much for having me. I love your questions, and it's been a lot of good thoughts.
My absolute pleasure. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.